4 p.m. right here at KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. This is DJ Ramsey, and welcome to another episode of Arabology, the show that attempts to take you on an Arabian musical journey, and attempts to do so through music and songs and gorgeous instrumentations, as well as interviews with people whose work informed the region, along with some gorgeous music. And speaking of gorgeous music, how about some Egyptian project? A song called the Yeah, Amar. That song goes out to Tanya S., as well as all the wonderful listeners who enjoy the Egyptian project. I'm glad you're able to join me on this wonderful Thursday afternoon right here at KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM.
Yeah, Amar, ya rayah, ala baladi. سلم لي على كل حبايبي يا قمر يا رايح على بلدي سلم لي على كل حبايبي امتى اشوفك يا حبيبي امتى اشوفك يا حبيبي يا قمر يا رايح على بلدي سلم لي على كل حبايبي حبيبي وانت بعيد عني روحي يا روحي بتروح مني حبيبي وانت بعيد عني روحي يا روحي بتروح مني ماهوش بإيدي غصب عني انك تكون بعيد عني مش بإيدي غصب عني إنك تكون بعيد عني روحي يا روحي بتروح مني والشوق يزود
Are you digging those smooth and creamy sounds that you're hearing on KZSU Stanford? Well, if you are, here's a thought. You could put your money where your ears is. That's right, man. Donate to KZSU or give us a call at 650-723-9010. And one of our happy DJs will be so pleased to hear from you. Thanks, and don't forget to keep on listening.
It is 4:06 right here, PM at KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. And if the studio seems a little livelier today, it is only because of the presence of Jeff, who is one heck of a student. He was one of my old students of Arabic, and apparently still remembers the language. I'm looking forward to speaking with him as I say ahlan wa sahlan to the show. But in the meantime, ladies and gentlemen, I was going to play for you the first part of an interview with Wissam Yafi, an interview that I conducted very recently. I don't know if you guys know who he is. Wissam Yafi was born and raised in Lebanon and educated and living in the U.S. right now in Washington, D.C. He obtained economic development expertise and training from Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government, having studied under Jeffrey Sachs, Danny Roderick, Jeffrey Frankel, Iqbal Qadir, and Michael Porter. He has been writing on subjects ranging from Middle East politics to economics, to technology policy, and has published op-eds in the Middle East through newspapers and outlets such as the Daily Star and Al Jazeera. A technologist by trade, Mr. Yafi has traveled extensively and within the MENA region from the Mashriq to the Maghrib, giving him the opportunity to meet leaders, policymakers, academicians, religious figures, and citizens at large. Here's my interview, the first part of my interview with Wissam Yafi. I was delighted to meet him last week as he was here at Stanford. And in this part, he's going to be speaking a little bit about his work, his research, and his book, Inevitable Democracy in the Arab World, New Realities in an Ancient Land. This book, ladies and gentlemen, is kind of prophetic because in this book, Wissam Yafi actually predicted the Arab Spring way before it happened. Let's listen to part one of this interview right here on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. This is the Arabology Show. I'm your DJ Ramsey, and thank you for joining me. I'm sitting here with Wissam Yafi at the Stanford Language Center. Wissam Yafi is an international development practitioner, technologist, and writer. He is the founder of Tidwit, a social learning high-tech firm based in Washington, D.C., which helps governments, nonprofits, and businesses worldwide to educate and share their knowledge with their communities in new and innovative ways. Wissam has traveled extensively through the world, particularly in the Middle East and North Africa, from the Mashriq to the Maghrib, consulting with leaders, policymakers, academics, and entrepreneurs. He has published quite a few publications, including a book called Inevitable Democracy in the Arab World. That's in 2012. And we'll be speaking to him about that as well as many other aspects of his career right here on the Arabology Show, coming to you from KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. Wissam, marhaba, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to Stanford.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Is this your first time here at Stanford?
It is, and I'm so impressed. You know, I don't know why I haven't been here before. I have been in San Francisco and in the Bay Area, but never had the chance to stop by Stanford. So I'm just taken away by the beauty.
Well, welcome to our little place here. I know they've got you very busy the last couple of days. What have you been doing on campus, and what are you planning to do?
Lecturing for the most part, and so there's two communities that have been interested mostly with what I've been doing: the government community side with some of my writing as it pertains to the Arab world and the MENA region, the Middle East and North Africa region, and the business side as to what we've been doing with learning, as it pertains to the MENA region. So I can describe what some of this includes in a little bit, if you'd like.
Absolutely, because, I mean, in attempting to introduce you, it's very difficult to kind of say, you know, you are a technology expert, you're looking at, a technological aspect to the Arab Spring, for example, and at the same time, you're a prolific writer, and the attempt of, or to avoid categorizing you, how would you describe yourself?
Well, it's a nice question, because I had myself this dilemma a while back. And I remember when I was still studying at the Kennedy School of Government at the time, doing my graduate studies, I actually went to the dean and asked him the same question.
Wow.
I told him, you know, I've always been a technologist and a in business around the world. But I have this soft side that wants to do some, philanthropic work as well as government-related work, things that would change the world, so to speak. And I'm really grappling with deciding, which path to take. So he looked at me like that. It was Joseph Nye, actually, the dean of the Kennedy School at the time. And he said, why do you have to choose? Nice. And so I never chose. Wow. And so I try to balance it as much as I can. Sometimes one takes more time than the other, but I have to try and balance things back. So I work on both ends of things and try to see how they both can help the region, which is, the Middle East and North Africa, and specifically in Lebanon.
And do you find that there is sort of a community, not necessarily fellow Lebanese, community, but a community in the Arab world that is doing what you're doing? Is there some kind of movement that is attempting to sort of bring these two aspects together? I'm talking about the government, business, and politics a little bit all in one.
There are some, public-private partnership initiatives. Some of them come from organizations, NGOs for the most part. But I think there needs to be a lot more of that work done. I think to a certain degree, and I actually recently saw a publication by the Brookings Institute, which surveyed a bunch of, youth probably in their 20s and 30s, as to what business people, what they perceived the role of government, and whether that government kind of stood in their way. And it was interesting to see within all these Arab nations, the 20 or so Arab nations that were surveyed, the different perceptions of how these business folks saw their government. But the underlying, or I guess the overarching message, is that there's a lot more that could be done to bring together government initiatives to understand the private sector, and for the private sector to understand more the government. Increasingly now, with the democratization that's happening across the region, where people are actually having to start initiatives such as entrepreneurship, etc. So this basically takes on an even bigger dimension.
And so in terms of your education, Wissam, and for those few people out there who may not know, you were actually born and raised in Lebanon as a kid.
Yes.
And how did your journey begin?
Well, I was born and raised in Beirut. My family originally comes from Tripoli, but we never lived there. We lived in Beirut most of our life. And I was there until 87, graduated high school, and came straight to the U.S., Northern Virginia. And so got my graduate study, well, got my college studies first, and then my graduate studies. Did it a little bit too quick for my taste, now looking back at it, really. So I got my MBA at probably age like 20, 21. And then I started my first business. I was only 23 years old when I started my first business. It was a knowledge management.
Knowledge management business.
Yeah. So it was all content and learning based from the beginning, really. The business grew into South America. So I went and I lived in South America for a long time, which gave me an exposure that I hadn't gotten in my part of the world, which is the Arab world, which was really an abnormal, growing up circumstance, so to speak, because it was a wartime. So I couldn't see development as it was happening. So once, after a few years from living in South America, I wanted to learn more about development and how development interacted with business, etc. And so I came back and did my further graduate studies in public policy this time at the Kennedy School. And from then I started Tidbit with the aim of basically changing the world through better educational means.
Yeah, so we should spell that TIDWIT.
That's right.
Where did the name come from?
It's Tidbits of Wit is what it is.
Nice. So. Nice. So I saw this associated with you on the web. What exactly is Tidwit? Are you still sort of actively involved in the site?
Yes. Tidwit is a social learning platform that basically targets communities, be they organizations or private companies, And lately, we've been very involved with initiatives in different parts of the world to help on such topics as e-learning, entrepreneurship, employability. And so a lot of this requires educational tools. And Tidbit provides these online educational tools to enable these communities to learn quicker and in more efficient ways.
And are these communities in the Arab world, in the Middle East specifically, or is this sort of on a global scale?
It's right now our focus is, well, we expect it to be, it is on a global scale, but the focus has been developing into the Middle East because of a lot of the donor organizations wanting to find new ways to reach more and more youth. So we've done some great projects on entrepreneurship with online training in North Africa. And right now we're working on the Syrian refugees to be able to reach Syrian refugees with online learning. A lot of them do not have ways of going to school, but they do have smart access. And so we're working on those kinds of projects. Wow. We're working on a project to help the Lebanese Ministry of Education reach out to its public school students with their own curriculum, etc. So there's other initiatives, but it's not just limited to the Middle East, but at this point there's a lot of activity in the Middle East happening. Sure. And so we're happy to see that.
Yeah, because I'm looking here at you know, one of your projects here involving Syrian children through what you call emergency education.
Right.
Can you explain what that means?
Sure. Emergency education is essentially whenever you have critical situations such as Haiti with the earthquake or right now Syria with its civil war, you have a huge population that all of a sudden finds itself either out of work or out of school. And so aside from the basic immediate development assistance that they may need, like security and food and shelter, etc., the next phase is basically to try and attend to them with to keep their minds busy, to keep them busy, to keep them hopeful, and not to have them lose hope of the future. And this is really what's happening right now with the Syrian refugees. There's hundreds of thousands of them all over the region. Some of them are trying to get into schools, into public schools. Some of them don't have that opportunity. Regardless, we're not, you know, making any value judgment on who we want to help. We want to try and help as many as possible. And so we're opening up the platform to be able to support these kids. So we redigitized the entire Syrian curriculum, and we're making it available to them for free. And some of the local school systems, like the Lebanese school system, the Jordanian, etc., they're delivering their own curricula also to these kids. So at this point, we're finding ourselves also trying to help those school systems deliver their own curriculum to these kids as well as their own.
So you're working in conjunction with these Arab governments, like the Jordanian government and others, in order to facilitate the access and make the platform available?
Yes. Right now, we're working with the Lebanese is the first one. The Palestinians, believe it or not, have come back to us interested in it, because the Palestinian population has been dispersed over the past several decades, and so there are several school systems that, you know, they've got UNRWA, which has UNRWA, which is a UN agency that handles all the Palestinian refugees. So UNRWA has about, if I'm not mistaken, about 600 schools.
Wow.
600 schools throughout the region. And that's different from the curriculum that's being taught in the Palestinian territories, which in themselves have also multiple curricula because of Gaza and the West Bank, etc. So the Palestinians, once they learned about what we're doing, they approached us asking us to submit or find ways to help them unify the curriculum so that the Palestinian kids can start, you know, learning along the same lines, one. And two, part of the curriculum, which is very important, is getting them within a social community context so that these kids can start communicating with one another. And I think that really got the guys in, you know, within the Palestinian territories very excited. So the Palestinians, we're trying to work with those folks too. The Lebanese have been trying to push within their own public school system. And the Jordanians, we hope to be able to reach them as well.
So e-learning, I mean, it's, and I know I'm using this because we've been talking about it at Stanford, has, you know, that word causes a variety of reactions. There are some, what I might call purists, who believe that e-learning is sort of a second-rate experience and could never replace the actual learning experience, to a degree where they dismiss it altogether. And then there are those who strongly believe in it and in its power to reach, as you said, people who otherwise don't have access to anything. In what ways do you, how do you see e-learning, and how do you see it developing not only in terms of the communities you're talking about, but even academically?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think our own view of what's happening with e-learning is we're not one of those, I guess, technologist purists from the other side saying that e-learning is going to replace traditional learning. We actually believe that schools and classrooms we don't want them to disappear. What we believe is that e-learning can support that function, either in an extracurricular way or to be able to strengthen the material that you can't really cover within a 30 to 40 or 50 minute period. That's under normal circumstances. Under abnormal circumstances, you may not have that choice. Mm-hmm. So you can't really send 1,000 teachers into harm's way into a city like Homs or Hama or Halab in Syria to try and teach these kids. Some of these teachers have left. Right. So if the only alternative is to be able, if the only other alternative is not to teach at all, then why not try to provide through e-learning a way for them to be able to learn but also interact within a community environment? We're hoping that that does not become the only learning methodology. Once peace comes back to these nations, that they will go back into the classroom and look at these solutions as continuing complementary tools. But I'd like to give you an interesting anecdote. So we were in Lebanon kind of doing a field study of what's going on, and we went to a school. It wasn't during the summer, so the schools were out, but there was this makeshift school that was teaching some of the Syrian refugees. And they were teaching them English, because the Lebanese curriculum is trilingual, English, Arabic, and French, whereas the Syrian is just purely Arabic. So there was some kind of makeup that these kids needed to do to be able to get up to speed to some of the English. So you had these volunteers from Sweden, Australia, US, etc., trying to teach those kids in that classroom. And those kids, remember, they've never, you know, had formal education in English before. And they, for the most part, you wouldn't expect them to understand much e-learning tools. And yet what these teachers were doing in the classroom is whenever it got noisy or they thought that they were losing the attention of the kids, they would switch on their laptops, they had connectivity, and they would put on videos of YouTube. And we saw it live. And wow. These kids, all of a sudden, you know, they would be captured by what they
by
were
the
seeing.
Wow.
So again, that kind of gives you an example that there were teachers, there were classrooms, but these tools were complementary and strengthening. Now, the next thing pedagogically that's going to happen is that these kids are going to say, well, you know what? That was YouTube. If I have a laptop back home, I could also do YouTube. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, it takes on a life of its own.
Absolutely. Wissam, I mean, and then we're talking about, you know, these dire situations, these very difficult circumstances that are affecting the MENA region. And what about in a more, you know, academic setting like Stanford? Do you feel that e-learning should be, for example, part of every class curriculum or class structure, or are you hesitant about making any judgments at this point?
Actually, I think it already is in so many ways. Even if it's not formally recognized, I think the tools that are available to the generations that are within the university academic environments right now, they're already so connected that in one way or another, you could argue that it's already integrated within the academic setting. Now, I guess the question is whether or not to formalize it.
Yeah.
And I have mixed feelings about this, frankly. I mean, even though I come from an e-learning environment, I have mixed feelings in the sense that I love to sit and talk to a professor. I love to, you know, one of my, I guess, memorable experiences from my Harvard days was to have conversations with fellow students who are smart, traveled, You know, you could look into their eyes and admire them for who they were. You're not going to get that from just, you know, going onto a page and kind of reading, although it's helpful. So I guess my own conclusion from this is, I'd love to see formal learning continue as it is, but where I would love to see it go is more and more in becoming this interpersonal communication where, you know, I'm sitting within a classroom setting, having discussions, discussing cases, etc. And all the base stuff learning that I could, you know, I don't need to waste my time on during the classroom, I could access in an e-learning setting, books and, you know, downloads and all that kind of stuff.
I love your answer because it seems to come up with the same argument on both sides and address both the concerns in a way that marries them instead of seeing them as being contradictory. Wissam, I'd like to really talk to you about this book.
Sure.
Can you tell us about Inevitable Democracy in the Arab World, published in 2012?
Correct.
And the statement that I keep hearing, which of course is being simplistic perhaps, but Wissam Yafi predicted the Arab Spring and the role that technology played in that, in what's going on. How do you react when people say that?
I'm not one to claim, you know, to want to claim over credit, but the prediction per se, I think many people predicted change. So I wasn't the only one that was actually starting to see fundamental change in the region. I think the difference of what I did from some of my fellow, thinkers or those who were studying the region is that I took one step further and I said, well, change is coming, it's inevitable, and what is going to happen afterwards is democracy. And I basically, the entire hypothesis of the book that I started writing in 2003 and finished in 2005 was how that would occur. And so that, I think, if there's one differentiator from what I did from some of the other fellow thinkers or those who were studying the region, was that not only did I say change was impending, but in coming up with the theory or the hypothesis, I had to study all the potential results going forward. And I reached the conclusion that democracy was going to always be, that also be inevitable as well.
كل ليالي انتظري شوام كل صباح اطرح السؤال كيف يسير العالم كيف يسير العالم كيف يسير العالم ايش نعمل ايش معمول نسوت ساتني ايش نعمل ايش معمول مشات وخلتني من أنا هل أنا قبيح هل أنا مختلف هل أنا عربي هل أنا أوروبي هل أنا أندي هل أنا أسود كيش نعمل واش معمول يوني مشت وخلتني كيش نعمل واش معمول قلبي دايما دايما صافي لكن واجب الأفراغ الأزبل في هذا اليوم الصعب لم أنا مثله في حياتي في حياتي هذا اليوم اليوم إضراب هذا اليوم المضرب كيفاش نعمل واش معمول الدنيا مشت وخلتني اتسافر النجوم اتسافر مع حبيبي كل أيام وهو يوم أسود في حياتي بعدودي والأحراط كيش نعمل وش معمول الدنيا مشت خلتني كيش نعمل وش معمول عيوني مشت للسماء خلتني
Looks like a great day on the water.
You bet.
But drinking and boating just don't mix.
Hey, I only had a couple of drinks. Besides, I'm not driving.
You see, whether you're operating a boat or just a passenger, even one drink can make you lose your balance.
Whoa, who's moving the boat?
Cause you to fall overboard.
Whoa!
And even drown.
Hey, get me out of here!
When you're on the water, don't drink. A public service message from Mothers Against Drunk Driving, the California Department of Boating and Waterways, and
KZSU Stanford.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is 4:36 p.m. right here at KZSU Stanford, 90.1 FM. You're listening to the Arabology Show with yours truly, DJ Ramsey. And during the first part of the show, you heard the first part of my interview with Wissam Yafi, who is a technologist as well as a leading key figure in terms of policy making that affect the MENA region. MENA, of course, is the Middle East and North Africa region. In the next part of my interview, the second and last part of the interview, we're going to listen to Wissam discuss his book, Inevitable Democracy in the Arab World, New Realities in an Ancient Land. This book, which initially was ready for publication around 2004-2005, actually predicted the Arab Spring and the events that followed. So in many ways, it is very interesting to sit with Wissam Yafi and see what made him realized that the Arab Spring was coming way before anybody else sort of ever thought that that would be possible.
So Wissam, you kind of explained in your answer how a book that was published in 2012 could have predicted the Arab Spring, because as you said, you initially started it a lot earlier. What was the process and what years were you working on this until it eventually was published, I guess, officially in 2011?
Yeah. Well, I started writing the book in 2003,
wow.
Right after the Iraqi war. And so the factors that I was looking at were geopolitical, geoeconomic, social, and technological, those four factors. And I submitted it for publication in 2005 to several university presses. It was rejected.
Ah.
It continued to be rejected. And my first lecture I gave in 2005 on the book was at George Mason University, which is my undergraduate alma mater. And it was with a fellow professor who actually ran for office afterwards, and he's in office right now. He's a Lebanese American by the name of David Ramadan.
Huh.
And so so that was the first lecturing I started in 2005. In 2000, I believe it was 2007, I lectured at Harvard on the book, and I lectured again in 2009, and then in 2011. In 2011. It got picked up by Palgrave immediately, I think right after Tunis happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it took them a few months to basically bring it up.
I mean, I'm really loving this, Wissam, because here you are telling them, this is what's going to happen. This is, take a look at this analysis. It can be quite enriching for what is about to happen. And perhaps getting the manuscript rejected because it just seemed like such a impossible thing to happen so quickly and to develop so quickly. Did things develop more or less along the lines you anticipated or predicted? Meaning, did you expect it to snowball this quickly?
That's a fantastic question, and I'll answer it the following two ways. In 2005, I think the reason why the manuscript was being rejected was because most of the people that were analyzing the topic were really looking at one of the four factors, which was the geopolitical, what was happening in Iraq for the most part. In Lebanon, when 2005 the revolution happened in Lebanon, to me that was a clear sign that it's not just the geopolitical aspect that was occurring, but there were other factors at play. And so my hypothesis was correct. Now, I did think that it would, because of the Iraqi war, things would go quicker. But by 2005, they hadn't, and people started seeing the negative aspects of the war. And so a lot of the people thought, this isn't going to happen. And so I think when people were reviewing the manuscript, they may have thought, no, you know what? This is just a complete catastrophe, and so there's absolutely no way it could happen, and so we're not going to put our necks on the line for it. So to answer your question, I guess, is I did expect there to be a complete link within the region of everything that was going to happen. Mm-hmm. I did not expect things to start in Tunis or to go on to Egypt or Libya. I mean, it wasn't that kind. And actually, I mean, there was one clear hope that I had, which is the hardline regimes would actually be able to benefit from this kind of an analysis, which is, since it is inevitable, why fight it? Why not liberalize and try to open up? And unfortunately, it created in some of the more hardline regimes, such as the Gaddafi regime and the Assad regime, etc., you saw a complete reversal because they saw it as existential. So they fought back the change that was occurring. I would have, you know, in my book, I was hoping that there was, this would not occur, but unfortunately it did, and sometimes, you know, things occur. But it doesn't change the dynamics, and it doesn't change the fact that change is still happening. Revolutions are happening, counter-revolutions are happening, but that the end game is going to be democracy, because there is no other self-sustaining system.
So you still believe that today? You still believe we're not there yet, but that democracy is coming? And by democracy, I mean real democracy in the Arab world?
Absolutely. I think some people try to kind of parse what democracy means to the US and Europe and other places. And there might be some you know, slight variations. I mean, it's, but that kind of becomes an academic type of an argument. But democracy per se, I think, is gonna result, or one of the underlying reasons why, is because if you look at, you know, if you're convinced that change is occurring, then you look at all the other alternatives. And I looked at all the other alternatives, everything from theocracy to chaos to liberalization, but, you know, for it to stay as an autocracy, etc. And none of the alternatives seem to be able to solve the root problem of the region, which is more on the geosocial and economic side. So it's not democracy because we want to imitate the West. It's democracy because it's the only system that will give these people a way to self-sustain themselves. But then also that automatically means they're going to have to, you know, become self-determining. So that's where democracy comes in. It's not because it's the right thing or because it's a modern thing. It's because there is no other self-sustaining system that can actually support these masses of people that are out there looking for jobs and looking for work and wanting to educate their kids, just like people here in the US and in Europe. So that's how you, if you get to the conclusion that way, then you immediately reach the conclusion that there is, that then it is going to happen. And that's essentially what my argument is.
And just looking at the data and the hard work you've done and your oeuvre in general, I have to say that I'm particularly struck by your humanity when you speak about these communities. The fact that you haven't detached yourself from the fact that these are children and refugees and Syrians, how much of that affects you, you know, personally?
A lot, because, I mean, I lived through it and I was an immigrant because of war. And so I left my homeland, my roots, in a very, in a very sudden way that, you know, keeps you attached somehow. But, you know, you either react to it negatively or you try to find ways to help. And so I think I've, you know, having become a U.S. citizen and received my education, and I was really one of the privileged ones, you know, it's one way to give back to the community. And I think it actually helps both my adopted country, which is the U.S., to understand the region more. But also it helps my homeland and the people there who really need as much help as they can get. Because we are, I guess, living the potential future that they may have if the region gets on better footing.
Like they say in Arabic, "انت رافع راسنا مش بس اللبنانية بس من ذاكرة الوطن العربي مفتخرين في كون," which means that you are a shining example of a Lebanese American intellectual and humanitarian who has been able to combine so many different aspects of technology and literature and humanities and geography and etc. into one. What's next for you? What's next in the works?
Well, our big focus right now is on making sure that we can help as much as possible in educating the people back home through some of these technologies that are available, and in making sure that, you know, we can get our government here in the U.S. to support in the efforts as much as possible. And I say this because one of the biggest examples, success examples of U.S. policy, I believe, in the Middle East is the AUB, is the American University of Beirut. And I don't want to signal it out because I'm sure they've done other things. But this one particularly is very close to my heart. It's very close to where we live. And it's a shining example of the positive policies that the United States could deploy in the region within, you know, an educational perspective. And we're trying to help do some things that are similar using technological tools. So that's really the big push that we're after right now.
And so for people who want to find out more about you or how to get involved, I guess tidwit.com, is it?
That's right. It's tidwit.com is the organization that that I'm leading right now. And there's a lot of initiatives that, you know, on the tidwit.com site you can see, and some success stories that we've dealt with.
Great. And so if Stanford students or faculty or anyone listening would like to contact you, they would do so through the website.
Yes, please.
And hopefully this will further enhance this discourse that we're centering on.
I hope so.
Wissam Yafi, it has been a pleasure to speak with you. Delightful man and a shining example of what a truly successful Lebanese American is like. This is a a beautiful portrayal against a stereotype that we keep fighting these days, not only in America and Europe, but also even at Stanford. Shukran for coming. Shukran for speaking to our students. Yeah. And shukran for being the magnetic personality you are.
Well, thank you very much, Ramzi. It was an honor to be here.
يا عدو
يا
مهر
سولة
Unmistakable sound of the Lebanese ultra-hip, independent, and very, very creative band Masroua Leila. We heard a song called Ala Babu, which means Upon His Door. And that song will be the last one I'm playing on today's episode of Arabology. Arabology is ending early today. And if you don't know why, then you're probably one of very few people on campus, since as I've been walking around all day, everybody's been talking about the upcoming game for Stanford Sports Football versus Oregon. The game today between number 3 ranked Oregon and number 5 ranked Stanford is going to have conference title consequences and possibly national championship implications too. If Oregon can beat Stanford, they can leapfrog Florida State and continue on to a potential championship run. Well, good luck to both deserving teams. That will be at 5 p.m. is the pregame show, and then of course the game will be on around 6 p.m. It has been a pleasure to be with you, ladies and gentlemen. This is DJ Ramsey. The show is Arabology, and you are listening to KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. I'm delighted you were able to join me. Join me next week, where I'll have another interview with Jordanian artist Yazan Khalife. And many thanks to Wissam Yafi for the amazing interview he gave me on today's show of Arabology. We're going to switch now to Stanford Sports Football versus Oregon.
Well, thank you for the great introduction. We don't always get guys who know Stanford football as well as that. Of course, I am Sam Fisher alongside John Treat, and we would love to welcome you to the big game, the not technically big game, but the biggest game of the year, Stanford-Oregon edition of Stanford football on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM.